TFM.
This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, your source for the best audiobooks, including unabridged readings of the latest novels from the incredible family of Star Trek authors. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help this show and the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 229. Grudge Cat is a big Nirvana fan. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemecek. In this episode, we get ready for our trip to the 32nd century and the Season 3 premiere of Star Trek Discovery, discussing the premise, what the episode titles may reveal about the story, potential real-world parallels, the addition of transgender and binary characters, and more. But first, we discuss Kate Mulgrew's return to the franchise as Catherine Janeway. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, Larry, I thought I would find you here in the Ready Room, but I was not expecting all this cat hair, and you've got a cat around your neck. You must be getting ready for Discovery Season 3.
I've got a cat around my neck. No, I've just let my beard go, Chris. What do you think? Do you think...
Oh, that's your beard. You okay. I thought that was Grudge Cat, but it's just Larry Beard.
Not only is it not Grudge Cat, it's not even Grunge Cat, who for about 3 hours was... I misread. I had a typo. And I'm thinking, well, it's supposed to be dystopian in Discovery this next year. So I thought, yo, grunge, dystopian? Come on, Kurt Cobain? Sure. Seattle 90s? Of course.
Of course. I mean, I hear that Grudge Cat is a big Nirvana fan.
My Seattle friends are going to not let me forget I said that. Yeah. No, I'm just hanging out in the Ready Room here because, you know, I've been so animated for the last few weeks, I'm worn out. I enjoyed it, but I just stuck. I had to get a little grounded. I had to get a little down to earth here, so... Everything looks so much more saturated and detailed here in your Ready Room. So I'm getting revved up.
A bit more 3D, right?
A little more 3D. Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Shadows and highlights. Just a little more.
Now that sounds like a variation of an episode title from season 2 of Discovery.
I'm not even...
Shadows and highlights.
Oh, good. Cat around your neck. I was hoping was not a... I didn't remember that one too. Yeah.
That's like if the episode titles for Discovery were done in Japan, it would be something like that. Because here, especially movie titles, they're very literal. So Cat Around Your Neck would probably be the title of the episode where we first meet Book and Grudge Cat.
But so. Wouldn't it? And I'm not...
Probably so.
I'm not, you know, a Japanese culturist, but I have seen a few anime titles go by in my time. Wouldn't it be like... The very big mangy cat around my neck? Wouldn't it be like a few more adjectives in there somewhere?
It's quite possible. My favorite in recent years was Pixar's Up, which is a great movie title, and it conveys various meanings about that film. But the Japanese title of that movie translated is Uncle Carl's Flying House. It's exactly what happens in the movie.
Uncle Carl's wood and brick flying house with shingles on top.
And balloon attachment, yeah.
And balloon attachment.
Okay, so yeah, obviously we are here today just before the premiere of Star Trek Discovery Season 3.
Oh!
To do a little bit of a preview.
So we are doing Star Trek.
To talk a bit about what we might see. We are doing Star Trek. We're not doing Pixar or balloons or cats. Well, we might talk about cats a little bit more later, but we're going to talk about Discovery Season 3. But Larry, before that,
there's various news this week, but there was one bit of news that came out on the 8th that everybody's super excited about that I thought we should at least touch on, and that's the fact that Kate Mulgrew is returning as Catherine Janeway in Star Trek Prodigy. So first we had Picard, now we have Janeway coming back. How are you feeling?
They're even letting her expense her own coffee. So I think she's really, really excited to be back. No, it was, there are so many Janeway fans. There are a lot in my, a lot of us know a lot of big Janeway fans and Voyager fans overall, but especially Janeway and Kate Mulgrew and what she's done with her career and life. And look at Kate Mulgrew. She doesn't even have that actor monkey around her neck of, I don't want to just, I love Star Trek, but I can't only be known for Star Trek. So she's got to go off and be Red on Orange is the New Black, along with many other act. You know, she's done live theater. I saw her do her Kate Hepburn show years ago, and she's done her books. So here's Kate Mulgrew again, having a very full creative life in different threads, most of all having a film character that's been totally different than Janeway. So she's in a perfect place to come back and be comfortable in her own skin to play Janeway, even though she's, you know, let's remember she's being the voice of an animated series, but, you know, not full scale live acting on camera. But still, it's I'm so thrilled for all the Voyager and Janeway fans who, you know, and I mean, I was halfway expecting maybe for them to get her into Picard, too. She's already, you know, been in Picard via Nemesis, her cameo.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, I was expecting her to pop up in Picard as one of the legacy. Ooh, it's a cool legacy cameo there. And maybe that will still happen. But for now, this is great news.
Well, and few people in the Federation know more about the Borg than she does. So that would have made sense for her to be on Picard.
Yeah. Well, you know, they were going down the Borg playlist there pretty extensively. So, you know, good on them for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
What I felt bad for was that if we had not been in COVID times without a pandemic, I'm sure this would have been a reveal, if not at Star Trek Las Vegas, at New York Comic Con this weekend, you know.
Oh, right.
And I'm sad that she missed having her melt the internet down day the way Sir Patrick got to do when they announced Picard.
Yeah.
You know. But
yeah, that would have happened. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
But it still had a huge impact. There was still a little bit of Janeway melt. Janeway was trending for a while on Twitter that day, which was cool.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned Nemesis. That's the last time we saw her. That was 18 years ago. Basically, Nemesis premiered on December 13th of 2002. So we're almost 18 years away from that. Now, in that movie, she was Admiral Janeway.
Yes.
But so far, in everything that I have seen, including the official press releases from Nickelodeon, they're continuing to refer to her as Captain Catherine Janeway, not Admiral Janeway, which would make sense to me if we're talking about a group of cadets or young Starfleet officers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Janeway is somehow involved with the Academy. My guess is this is just simply, everyone knows her mainly as Captain Janeway, and so they're just using that terminology. But it did get me thinking, we don't actually know yet of the time period for this series.
That's true.
We don't know when it's set. So could it possibly be set before Voyager?
It could. I mean, I don't, you know, if you really want to get picky and somebody wants to say, well, the timbre of her voice is 20 years older than it was when it was on, you know, I mean, somebody wants to get, but you can, it's animation. You can tweak that easily if that's a really big deal. Otherwise.
Hey, it doesn't have to be animation, Larry. Just ask Stuart Baird. You know, Michael Dorn's voice, not quite low enough for me. I think we can tweak that.
Yeah. Oh, God, I forgot that. That's a case. But here's the thing also. This is wonderful. This is great. It's wonderful PR for Prodigy. It's going to slowly dawn on people that this is a Nickelodeon show, not CBS All Access and something else overseas or not. Nickelodeon is pretty global to begin with. I know there are national differences and reflecting cultural differences, but still, Nickelodeon has a global structure. You know, and it was a Viacom company anyway, but it's global to begin with. So that speaks well of everybody being on board and being able to see this in most pockets of the world. So that's awesome. That's a whole different dynamic than we're going to have before. But also, we don't know exactly. It makes sense to lead with with Janeway, just as you led with Sir Patrick. But that series was called Picard. This is not Star Trek Janeway. It's Star Trek Prodigy. It's young adults. It's going to be 3D CGI type animation, not 2D quasi-traditional looking like Lower Decks. And this is going to be aimed at young adults. This is going to be angstier and tweensier, whereas Lower Decks is really like an adult snarky animation, you know, Adult Swim type animation. And kids can watch if their parents are there and don't mind too much. Don't hear too many lines said under their breath. But the point here is that they've led with her. They've announced some things. They've got the writing staff out there, for the Hageman brothers and their staff, and it's all out there. And this is kind of like, aside from that one log line about it's a bunch of teens who get a ship and it helps them, you know, become more noble somehow. An old Starfleet vessel that they, you know, they commandeer or whatever. Aside from that, this is like the first concrete, real piece of plot. But here's the thing. It makes, if she's in the cast, it totally makes sense to lead with her. But is she, you know, is she the Charlie calling in on the box to talk to the angels? I mean, is she the Bosley?
That would be awesome if so.
I mean, is she the Bosley? My point here is, I don't think it's going to be, here I am, Janeway, and these kids are in my, the back of my little, she's going to be off somewhere or in touch or something. I'm just thinking the focus of the show is going to be on the teenage, the young people, right?
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
at
yeah,
most,
yeah.
she'll be in yeah. a lot of, and they're, you know, but they're going to use her to be the connection to establish Treklandia. But I'm just thinking that for everybody who say, yay, this is going to be, don't fall into the Picard trap where it's like, yay, it's the adventures of Captain or Admiral Janeway again, or Commander Janeway, whatever the hell it is. I don't think that's quite, you know, the thrust is still teenagers commandeering a Starfleet ship. It's like they've got her kidnapped in the back and they go back and consult with her on something every, you know, she's going to be off somewhere and maybe they're hunting for these kids, or maybe she's their secret ally. People are hunting them for some reason, but she knows what's really going on. Or maybe they're on us. They become secret agents, but they're young people and she's the only one that knows. It's like an alias Smith and Jones. There's a reference for you. It's like she's the one contact that knows what's really going on, and she has to be in touch with them as they run around the galaxy having their adventures and, you know, learning how to be noble and Starfleet-y, even if they're rejecting it. Yeah. Does that make sense? That's my first take. I have no clue, guys and gals, about what's going on here, but that my gut reaction is it's great to ballyhoo her before we get to all these other new and, you know, new characters and unknown voices. I say unknown voices. But as she's going to be the star power that's going to marquee the show right now. But that doesn't necessarily mean she's going to sit in the captain's chair 24/7 in all the footage.
Well, no, I'm sure she'll be someone. I don't know if it'll be like Charlie calling in. Maybe she's going to be like the Mr. Belding of the show as a Saved by the Bell reference.
I didn't mean to blow you out of the water. I didn't mean to blow you out of subspace with that analogy.
Certainly it's not going to focus on her, but it would be interesting to know, is she just going to be there here and there in moments or to send them off, or are they going to check in with her in each episode, or how's that going to work? Rolling back, you mentioned the Nickelodeon thing, and last time we talked, we were talking about Lower Decks, but we talked about Prodigy and Nickelodeon, and I said, well, we don't have Nickelodeon in Japan and so forth. And the news has come out, of course, that CBS All Access is going to be rebranded as Paramount Plus.
Yes.
Which I'm hopeful that the Paramount brand is going to open up the floodgates in terms of international availability. Mm-hmm. And we do have Nickelodeon content in the CBS All Access app. So if Paramount Plus is able to be available in various countries such as Japan, where we don't have it right now, UK, Australia, places that aren't able to see Lower Decks, for example, maybe that's also going to open up Prodigy as well as Lower Decks and the rest of the content to people. Very hopeful that that will happen.
Yeah, keeping an eye on. Yeah, I have many Portales and Portal 47 and people that just listen to my other shows and on my boards. And I've got lots of, everybody around the world is very good about keeping me honest to get out of my little American bubble. I know your perch there is the same way. And be mindful of the fact that, you know, we have this universal internet and social media, and yet we have a big chunk of half the world audience is still grousing about not being able to see Lower Decks legally anyway. So let's hope that Paramount Plus new paradigm or return to an old one given new media, will open those doors for people.
Yeah, hopefully. And you mentioned the kind of the premise of the show. I checked the Nickelodeon press room, the official press release, and what language they're using for this. It's really interesting. They say that Prodigy follows the adventures of a group of lawless teens who discover a derelict Starfleet ship and use it to search for adventure, meaning, and salvation.
I knew I had that meaning, adventure, and salvation. I knew I left it somewhere. Next time, if you'd put your meaning, adventure, and salvation, if you'd put it away where you left it, we wouldn't be in this mess. Just keep searching for it.
I don't know. I just found the inclusion of salvation in this list of reasons, things they're achieving by stealing the ship is very interesting.
There can be...
So I'm really curious what the story is going to be.
You know, there's salvation doesn't necessarily... I mean, part of my mind leaps to theological implications, but you could look for salvation from a lot of things, from past, you know, legal wrongs, if not moral wrongs.
Participation in Red Squad.
Or even Nova Squadron.
Who knows? All right. So, yeah, it's going to be good to see Janeway on there. Quick note, Kate Mulgrew, they did this virtual panel for New York City Comic Con. Mm-hmm. And Kate Mulgrew said, I have invested every scintilla of my being in Captain Janeway. And of course, again, she used Captain. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to endow her with nuance that I never did before in Star Trek Prodigy. How thrilling to be able to introduce these young minds yes. to an idea that has elevated the world for decades. To be at the helm again is going to be deeply gratifying in a new way for me. Now, she did say to be at the helm again. Is she letting something slip there? Is she the leader of this ragtag crew of rebels that are looking for galactic salvation?
I don't think. No, I think they're just being cute and trying to be clever and all that. But I heard her, you know, I heard the panel live and it's the text here, but she actually mentioned this two or three times. This whole idea of, you know, animated and animations for kids. And I hope we're finally I've been preaching this for a couple of years now. We're getting the point where this is, you know, the buffet analogy. We're going to have different. A lot of people still see all these as Kurtzman Trek, but we're going to keep on seeing the diversity, the different flavors and stripes, you know, of these Star Treks at this buffet. Much less the fact this is on Nickelodeon. We'll have a different audience reach and potential and all that. But the fact that if Lower Decks wasn't really a kid's show, this is. This is like a young adult show. And she's glommed on the idea of the whole Roddenberry thing. We're going to get it to them early on. And she's excited about that. And she's right. That's, you know, if that sounds subversive, well, we could use a little more of that subversiveness in the world. And she's perfect to take it on, you know, in teamwork with all of them. So but I'm excited.
I am going to be really fascinated to know what the time period is because.
Yes. And what uniforms they're not wearing.
The role that her, of course, given the Titan that we just saw last week. Because whether she's a Captain Janeway who has yet to take command of Voyager or Admiral Janeway who has gotten her crew back from the Delta Quadrant has a huge impact on how she would interact with the other characters. So I'm really curious to see what we're going to get there.
It's also interesting this if they're actually are teenagers, young people, and she's whatever, even if she's a commander, captain, whatever. I don't know. It's going to be really fascinating to see Janeway be explored as a maternal figure because we've never seen that ever before.
Are you being sarcastic?
I'm being sarcastic, yes.
Although her growth in that area was one of the great parts of Voyager. And especially after Jerry Ryan came aboard
Would have been fun in a pilot of Voyager if she said, no kids on the bridge. And then you see Harry Kim kind of skulk off the bridge. It's about.
And then she told Chakotay, please don't let me make an ass of myself in front of children.
Yes.
Okay. Why don't we move on, Larry? Let's talk about our main topic for today, which is Star Trek Discovery Season 3, which will be premiering just 4 or 5 days after we're recording this on Thursday. So basically 4 days from now. We've seen a lot of the teasers out there. And the show seems to really be shifting tone. They've gone so far as to even change the logo. The new logo is very interesting to me because if you contrast the one that they were using, which seemed to just be an evolution of the J.J. Kelvin timeline Star Trek identity, if you contrast that with this new one, to me, the new typography, the new lighting, everything about this new logo feels more in line with the Star Trek that we've had in the past in terms of the way of looking at the future, sort of that Gene Roddenberry vision of the future. I'm sure there are people out there who think, oh, it's just a logo, who cares? But, you know, just like Grunge Cat, who you talked about earlier, that grungy Star Trek Discovery logo that we had and all the conflict that we've had up to this point compared with this logo and a story that seems to be about discovering what happened to the Federation over a long period of time, 930 years, and its fall, and how do we get it back? It just has a whole different feel as we head into the season.
Well, as they were doing those minuscule, you know, okay, number one, we've had this weird situation, and I'm going to rant about this again. This whole idea, and let me get my dates straight here. So they began filming this season in July of 2019. So we're bearing down on a year and a half ago. And then they shot for 7-8 months. They finished up in February. February 24th was their wrap day. And they obviously meant to have it out before now. And then COVID set in and not only slowed down post-production, but slowed down the airing. And they swapped with Lower Decks and, you know, that's all coming out. So it's just for all the, and now they're working on season four right now, however that looks in COVID time. And hopefully they're trying to start shooting, however that looks, you know, in Toronto and whatever their national cultural things are about shooting in the pandemic, the social distancing at work and all that, the protections. But this thing about this, it's almost like an old school warp bubble stretch rubber band effect that they're doing with pre-digital technology to try to get the Enterprise to stretch to go into warp in 1987. It's like that's the temporal snapback that I feel here. They started filming this a year and a half ago, and we're just now seeing it out. That's like the worst of any streaming. Not the worst. It's among the worst of these. Oh my gosh! I've had three kids since we started filming this episode, and now I'm talking about the premiere. You know, the digital online premiere is going to be on coming up Wednesday. But anyway, that's all affected this too. So it'll be interesting to see if realizing when this was being, and they started filming in July. They were writing months before that, so they were writing as the first one was unspooling. So that's a step thing. Yeah. But your comment about the poster, the Discovery it's like back in Micrograma extended-ish, you know, kind of old school, you know, Franz Josef Schnabelt technical manual, you know, a ship's hull kind of font. And I don't know, it's like I look at this poster and it's, you know, it's got the sun coming through the gray clouds. I almost want to sit, you know, like gray skies smiling at me, nothing but gray skies. Did I see, you know, whatever. But this whole thing, it's like they're on the, I just get a Les Mis feeling here. It's like they've got the, I want them all to break out in a chorus of da-dum, 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 da-dum. You know, it's, so you, the vibes are there. But yeah, there's a lot of storytelling going on in this key art, the way the kids say now.
It's an optimistic visual to me. When I look at it as a designer, it feels, I feel the attempt. While the story, the concept of the story may feel dark and hopeless, I feel like they're trying to convey an optimism through the shift in the visuals. And that's something that I'm happy to see.
Well, and again, right, I was kidding and badly singing, but there's gray clouds with the sun peeking out to break up. Like you see the beginning of a sunny day behind the gray. And that's, you know, there's an on the nose metaphor for them for what they're, you know, what they're trying to pitch. I just think overall, and I know we'll get into this too. I just think, I mean, like I've enjoyed Discovery. I'm glad it's there, but we all know, and I keep trying to say, and I know people never liked it. I know people that have liked the second season more than the first. The second season lit up so much that we're launching a whole unexpected series out of it with Pike and Spock in number one. Mm-hmm. Anson Mount and Ethan Peck and Rebecca Romijn and all that. That was an unexpected, you know, woo, okay. So, yay, most people enjoyed the second season more than the first. But aside from just enjoying it, it just was more grounded because it didn't have the chaos of the first season. And all of this,
right.
You know, and Brian Fuller's original pitch was about being an anthology series with the same group of actors playing different characters, you know, hopscotching across the Star Trek timeline, playing different characters in different time periods. But no, we've got to have, if we're going to make these action figures, we're going to want them to sell for more than one Christmas. You know, so I get that too. I understand them wanting that. So this overall, if season two was like to me a huge improvement in just the stability and the appeal of Discovery, this feels like for the first time mm-hmm. with this crazy spring forward. I know a lot of people were being cynical about not having any canon to deal with. It's just your way of, you know, being a madman about what you're going to do with story. Like, I'm out of control. I can do what I want. Like, you're throwing a tantrum with this. Like, no, it's not that. I am unbound. You know, it's like Atlas Unchained. Burnham Unchained. No, it's like, oh, I think they're going to be able to be more comfortable in their skin. I think this feels more like what Discovery's always tried to want to be, and shoehorning it in, you know, we've already debated that and talked about it till the cows came home, Andorian cows or right. whatever.
Yeah.
That's where blue milk comes from, apparently. I'm amazed they don't have an utter catastrophe of that system. But I say this. I'm excited for this season. I think I am more excited for... I was excited to see Anson Mount and Ethan Peck and Spock and see what they would do with it. But I've all along been kind of, okay. And I know there are lots of talented creatives. I know there are lots of Star Trek fans, new and old, or veteran, I should say. But it's just been kind of a getting all the pieces of the, you know, the well-oiled machine we used to talk about. It's been a challenge to get that up and running through all the travails out of the gate. And then everything mm-hmm. has felt like a reaction to the initial setup. Like, what are we going to fix? What are we going to tweak? What are we going to do now to kind of make up for the, you know, the really horrible yeah. labor pains at the beginning? And this season feels like even more of a restart. Well, it's obvious it's a reset. They're going 930 miles across. They're going to be in the beta quadrant somewhere. Which is going to be interesting because we're either back on Trill or we're in a Trill colony, or we're going to learn a lot about what's happened in that 900 years of expansion. So, you know, it looked mm-hmm. like the baths there were the same ones on Trill, but maybe not the ones with the symbionts in them that we saw in a couple of glimpses. So, you know, that's mm-hmm. that whole setting and the fact that Burnham is separated at first, she meets this David Ayala's character Book. And they're on their own. And I think I've read somewhere where it takes a year. We've seen the reunion moments in some of the promos where she's back with the rest of the crew.
Yeah.
But maybe I've read somewhere where that's actually the early episodes, she's on her own or she's with him for like a year before she finds the ship again. You know, we're seeing all those moments.
Yeah, I haven't read if it's a year, but I do know that she has to find mm-hmm. her shipmates.
Yeah.
So there's a time period that's going to pass, yeah.
Well, and they make a big point of the time lapse of her hair being all different styles and lengths and, you know.
Yeah. I love her hair.
To show the time passing. Oh, yeah, it is. But, I mean, as a device to show time passing, you know.
Yeah. You know, and I think in the beginning, actually, when she first meets Grudge Cat, it's Grudge Kitten.
Oh, okay. I'm looking into my speaker here to see how facetious you're being.
Little bitty Grudge Kitten is so cute. And the next thing you know, it's climbing around your neck yeah. and just hanging out up there. And you're like, dude, you're too big for my neck now.
Grudge Kitty, Grunge Kitty, little ball of fur. Way off in the beta quadrant, fur.
See, that has to be on there. This has to be on the show. I really hope it is. Okay, well, let's talk more about this premise, Larry, this setup. So, yeah, a lot of people have had the thought that the jump to the future is a way of escaping canon. So you don't have to worry anymore about making everything fit in with what we already know. And even at the end of last season, basically, the position of Starfleet is we're not going to talk about Discovery anymore. Just they're mm-hmm. gone. Mm-hmm. They were never here. Just don't talk about them. So it's almost like an on-screen statement of, let's just get rid of the first two seasons, and now we're going to have this new thing that we're going to do. But it's an interesting idea to have them jump to the future. They're able to tell a story that they wouldn't be able to tell, even if they were just in the post-DS9 Voyager time period. Say they're in the 25th century, they wouldn't really be able to tell this story because the Federation could suddenly collapse, but you need time to pass after the collapse for a story to form.
Right.
And for them to explore what happened and what are the repercussions of the Federation collapsing. So they do need to jump ahead to do something like this. So the idea is very interesting. I just checked the dates. The Vulcan Hello is in 2256. Where No Man Has Gone Before was in 2265, so about 9 years. It's very, very close for them to try to tell a story. I've always felt like the Discovery writers, they really wanted to tell their own original story. They wanted to really chart their own course, which is great. And as a creative, I totally understand wanting to do that. The problem is if you put yourself within 10 years of 50 years worth of known content, it's really difficult. You're kind of putting yourself in a box. So now we've jumped ahead. The end of last season, Such Sweet Sorrow, takes place in 2257 mainly. And then we have this little jump ahead, this little coda in 2258. That Hope Is You, which is the title of the first episode of season three, takes place in 3187.
I love that song.
So we've just completely separated ourselves.
Wasn't that like a Carpenter's song or something?
I'm sure it must have been.
Sounds like a 70s ballad or something.
That Hope Is You.
That Hope Is You. That Hope Is You. Yeah. I don't.
Well, I'm hearing the Nirvana cover of the Carpenters' That Hope Is You right now, which is one of Grunge Cat's favorite
songs. I was going to say, I'm sorry, I'll try to grudge that up a little bit. Okay.
But okay, so now we're 930 years into the future. We're in the 32nd century, so there's really nothing for the writers to worry about. I mean, they do have to tie into the past, but everything they write about what's happening in the moment, they don't have to worry about how it fits in. They don't have to worry.
Well, they're on the leading edge looking backwards. And we're in the position.
Yeah, exactly.
We're in the position. We have the same point of view as the Voyager crew. The Discovery crew kind of relates. We know what happens to the Discovery crew's future, at least for another 100 years or so. But we are closer to them in that they're trying to figure out what's happened in that gap. They're just short 100 years. We know what's happened in that gap, you know, the same way. And now here's the thing, though. This is like a matter of semantics, maybe, but you keep saying, and a lot of people keep saying, the collapse of the Federation. From what it looks like, hey, there's still 8 seats in that Federation Council, or 6 seats, whatever the small number of stars is, 6, 7, 8. So it's not like the Federation has collapsed. It's like it's lost whatever the burn is, if it's a on-the-nose metaphor for a big, you know, a galactic pandemic or a galactic disaster, whatever it is, and that took a hard left, if they mean politically or if they just mean like structurally, like literally or figuratively, you're on the bridge and you've lurched, you know, the inertial dampers are out and everybody's fallen out of their chairs to the left. And that's kind of the image I keep getting is like the Federation took a hard left. It's like, oh, it's original series, and we've all been thrown from our chairs. But the fact that
the expression just means that something drastic
happened. Yes, it's not.
But I do think in this day and age, it's probably being interpreted as a political statement, which is interesting because it would kind of be the opposite of what you might expect the writers.
And maybe that's the implication that they're just throwing out there. But the whole thing about the stars on the flag. Even the modern, you know, the most up-to-date, and they keep tweaking the flag design, and it's gone through, you know, iterations since motion picture. And through all the different, you know, the Berman era, it kept flipping around and changing, much less what they did with Discovery and Picard. But the idea, clearly they're trying to say with a lot fewer stars on there that something has happened. But if you stop and think about it, how many member worlds were there? And like, they never, it's like on the American flag.
They never put on the ball on there, right?
500 stars on there or whatever. 300 stars aren't on the Federation flag. But it's by implication, some of the, if those are originals or members or founders and some of them are gone, or something's happened. Yeah. And it's more like, it's not, so to me, it's not like the Federation has collapsed. It's like it's been chomped in from around the edges, or, you know, it's like there's one piece of pizza left, but it's the middle because everybody came in and ate from around the edges, you know.
Well, my impression, so when I say collapse, I don't mean that it goes away, but I mean that if you have something that's very powerful and it becomes just a shadow of itself, then it has, in essence, collapsed. Now it's in a state of survival, I think is how I see the Federation in this situation. Now, I'm completely reading between the lines because we haven't been told very much, but just when I watch the visuals and when I think about what would have happened and when I think about what has happened to empires or great civilizations in our own history.
Oh, name one. No.
I get the impression I get the impression that at this point in time, like, the Federation still exists in name, but the remaining member worlds are trying to hold on, they're trying to survive, and they're a very small player on the galactic stage at this point.
Yeah. Well, it's like, look at Rome. Like, the most famous example we go back to, but then, like, when it split and you had the Byzantine Empire was the Eastern Empire, and then Rome, and then Rome's, you know, influence kept, you know, as the all the European states, you know, populated, and Rome just became less and less influential. And then the Holy Roman Empire, I mean, well, that's the church end of it. But I mean, the actual physical empirical part where the Roman legions could not keep up the borders anymore and everything, you know, the Huns and the Germanic people and all of that. And the English and the Gallic side of the empire and the northern African part. So, yeah, it's like there's a core hanging on, but it's just a shadow of what it once was, kind of a thing. And but there's still there are still flags. There are still people standing around looking like, you know, bureaucrats and ambassadors that are talking to them kind of like they're ghosts. So the idea has survived, but. And they act like Starfleet is like there's not a fleet, you know, the idea of armadas of ships. And there's all kinds of tantalizing things here. We don't know what caused it. But so two things. They've been very cool. And what, you know, made everybody giddy at first, the first time they dropped a Discovery trailer, all the alien, all the familiar species that we saw. And you know, and the crews are doing a great job. We saw Lurians like Morn. We saw, you know, Andorians all over the place. We've seen two or three, four more. I was madly looking for Tellarites, but I mean, there's a lot of them in there, and some of the more obscure, like DS90. So they're trying to make a point that all those planets are around, but the guys that we see things in is they're either like it's disorganized, or they're rebels, or they're outlaws, or there's just a. It's not just the Federation has fallen. It's like it's a little bit like we're talking about in Picard in the Neutral Zone, where there's been a vacuum of structure and, you know, legality and order and governmental authority, and people are just on their own. And that's the thing. The spooky thing, not spooky, what did I say that? The big question mark that was...
Because we're close to Halloween.
Oh, silly me. Yeah. Wow. That scared me how fast you were with that answer. the thing that underlies all this that I don't see anybody talking about that was like an assumption... But the further we go, I don't know if it's the assumption correctly. We talk about the time factor, right? Originally, they're very specific at the end of Discovery Season 2 about they've gone whatever the Red Angel suit, you know, distance was. We were figuring that. And it's obviously like over in the middle of the Beta Quadrant somewhere. And we even get that.
It's 51,000 whatever light years.
Yes. And if you think that the galaxy's, the main part of the core galaxy is 100,000, that's basically like the width, you know. So if you're kind of in the middle of the alpha, then you're kind of over in the middle of the beta now, you know, give or take. Even without being more specific, it's a whole hunk of a long way over. That's obvious. 51,000 light years. They specify. And you even get the little, like, you know, little flashing red light on the Enterprise, which I love that. It's like, wow, that's that beacon's got a hell of a long range on it to get to be picked up on the Enterprise, you know. I almost wonder if that's somebody plotting. Somebody could be faking that. Oh, look, it's like Spock has done that just so nobody will ask any questions. Oh, too far away for us to worry.
There's some guy at a station in the back of the bridge with a laser pointer.
Yes, exactly.
Shining
exactly.
It on the view screen.
Oh, good. So they all fell for the laser pointer at the back of the bridge.
They just wanted to make Spock feel better. His sister is okay.
Phew. Now let's all go off and never talk about this again. My point here is, are they really in, I get it that the time factor is probably there, but are they really in the middle of the Beta Quadrant, or do they start there and do they stay there? Now, originally I was saying, oh, look, they're on Trill. So they couldn't have stayed there. Now that could have been a Trill colony in 1,000 years, you know, seeing all those races running around loose, all those species, you know, are they really still out in the middle? It says two things. Either they're not really out in the middle of the Beta Quadrant still, or at some point they're not there anymore. Maybe they spore drive back over back into home turf, but it's not home turf because it's, a you know, 900 years later and the landscape has changed. Or maybe they start there and they come back. Or maybe that's an indication of how far all the Federation member worlds spread out before the burn happened. And there's lots of familiar faces out in the middle of the Beta Quadrant. And there's all these, you know,
which is very
these
possible.
Branch office Trill baths are out and around. You know, the pools for the symbionts are not just on Trill itself. So, but either way, that's a thing that I don't see people discussing, because part of this underpinning this is are they fighting this? We're going to bring, you know, this the Les Mis scene here with the flag, and we're going to help reestablish the Federation in this time, or they're going to time travel back at the end of it after a season. Whatever happens, is it all happening from that far, far, far perch? And that's just another part of the, we are so far out of canon parameters or guardrails. We can do what we want to do. We're not just in a different time period. We're way over here where we could even make up new stars and relationships. And it's all okay because we haven't, this is like behind the Klingon Empire. We're so far away, you know, on the backside. And that's a fascinating thing to me, because if that's part of it.
On the backside of the Klingon Empire.
Yes.
I saw your eyes light up, Larry, when you said they can even make up new stars. I think you're eyeing an updated stellar cartography there, aren't you?
Well, let's hope, Chris. Let's hope. Yeah, and a whole different layer of timing, right? But no, I mean, that's a thing. So part of this is going to depend on just how, you know, Voyager. I said this once before. Voyager was only lost in space, air quotes, by distance. But they were all still in the same time frame, aside from, you know, the whatever the time differential of the Romulan wormhole, right?
Right.
With Remor. Yeah. That was a slight thing. And it kind of gives you an idea, but that was nothing compared to 930 years. If it's time and distance both, that's even wilder. If it still remains a time factor and they somehow come back over our way, okay, fine. It's still the time factor to play with, but having time and distance is something even more fascinating to play with. At least, you know, but then again, you know, I'm like 1% of fandom, so don't look at me. But
yeah. Well, I mean, if we want to get super real life scientific about it, of course, there's going to be a time that goes along with a distance when we talk about these elements. But in Star Trek, you know, you just phone somebody up, have them on the view screen almost instantly, even though they're thousands of light years away from you. But what you're saying is very interesting. And unless I dreamed this, which is possible, I just watched the trailer, like the latest trailer introducing Discovery Season 3, and they did show Discovery spore jumping. So at some point, they get the ship up off the planet. The ship is functioning again. Right. And if they can spore jump, they can go anywhere in the galaxy instantly.
Well, the bottom line here is somehow they have to get Michelle Yeoh. They have to get Georgiou back. Assuming that Section 31 is going to be back in normal space or local space again, and that's not, you know, time and distance wise.
See, Larry, this is how I know you are not a Section 31 agent, because you called it Section 31. You're not cool like Ash Tyler, who just calls it 31. You know, back in 31, We have all the flavors of ice cream that we want. So, but
BR31.
As far as the Trill thing goes, maybe they do go to Trill. Maybe they spore jump to Trill, and we're seeing Trill in the 32nd century. And then they go back.
And then
I think it could be a good time here.
That's worse than a Gilligan's Island TV movie. Come on. They got away, and then they went back.
Well, they did that on Lost, right? At one point, they go back to the island. So, spoiler alert. I think it's a good time to talk about the episode titles because they reveal a little bit of what could be happening here. So all of the episode titles are known at this point.
And they had been for months, which is hysterical because they came out through, you know, production facilities and guild postings.
Had to go find them,
but
right?
But once they were there, they were there. Nobody tried to hide them in their industry sources. Yeah.
So the first one is called That Hope Is You, which I'm sure is Michael Burnham because it's Discovery and everything revolves around Michael.
Wasn't that a Renette song from like the early 60s, the girl groups? It just sounds like a girl group song. Okay.
The next one is called Far From Home. And then the next one is called People of Earth. Now, the Far From Home, obviously, they jumped. We've been talking about they jumped 51,000 whatever light years into the Beta Quadrant, which I have taken to mean is the planet that we saw in New Eden, because that was in the Beta Quadrant and it was like 51,000 light years. And that's where Burnham's mom had set up shop, I think at one point anyway, or she had been there. That's if I'm remembering correctly. But those people are from Earth. They were taken there by the Red Angel during World War III. So it could make sense that that's where they are at this point. But then you keep going down, you get down to, what is it, like the eighth or ninth episode, we have Terra Firma Part 1, Terra Firma Part 2. Now, Terra Firma,
yes.
I mean, it can just simply mean solid land, whatever, but it also could be a reference to Earth itself, actual Earth, right? And then there's the Citadel, the Good of the People, and then Outside to end it. So some of these episode titles are really interesting.
Ooh, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in is the one that's the most interesting to me. Am I jumping ahead here? Did you want to?
Well, you're going right into what I was about to connect, so go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying, unification, not just unification, but unification Roman numeral 3, which is a direct, it smacks so many people when these first leaked out and were found, discovered. People's unification 3, as in a follow-up to Unification 1 and 2, which were all about the Romulans and the Vulcans reunifying, right? It was the Spock episodes. And, you know, Sarek dies and the next generation. Then you throw in the fact that also we don't just have the episode titles. We've got the writers already who were attached to all these. And that is the one episode being written by Kirsten Beyer. Who is about as, you know, she's on the writing staff. Brian pulled her in the very first days to be there to represent the hardcore deep memory well. You know, we don't need a consultant. We've got Kirsten here. After all those wonderful Voyager books she did that weren't just about Voyager characters, she did what I'd been saying, you know, get out of this thinking that characters are attached to a series and that these are three different series worth of characters and guest stars and recurring people who were all living in the same time period. It's like, that's the universe. Get out of this box of thinking of series. And she did that with her Voyager book. She had people coming and going from that time frame. And she did it in a really cool way in the novels. She's been excellent. She's the one that first brainstormed doing a Picard series the way it was done, which is showing, oh, look, there's Seven. She's not a next generation character. What is she doing? It's the time, guys. They're alive in the time. And she is part of that plot. So, between the name being an obvious follow-up to Unification 1 and 2, and the fact that they've got the most deep-divingest canon-aware writer on staff doing that episode, and if this is all about how the Federation is a shell of itself, maybe one of those factors involves Vulcans and or Romulans. So, you know, we shall see.
Well, it could involve Romulans and Vulcans. It could also be a reference to not only reunifying those two races, but reunifying more of the races of the Federation, which then leads you two episodes later to Terra Firma, which could be possibly back to Earth, which is the home base of the Federation. The other thing about Unification 3, and the reason it immediately popped out to me, is that unlike most two-part episodes in Star Trek, which are so-and-so, comma, part one, and so-and-so, comma, part two, Unification is called Unification 1 and Unification 2. There's no comma, there's no part. Right. So by writing Unification Roman numeral 3 and not putting part 3 or anything behind it, it does appear, as you say, to be connected to those. Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, having done the Next Gen Companion back in the day, it was almost more like it was trivia. People say Unification Part 1 and Unification Part 2. And I don't, you know, from year to year, it's like whoever it was that did the memo that went to the titles company. And the fact that we have, you know, most of those two-parters would say Part 1 and Part 2. And they would always use Arabic numerals, not Roman numerals. But the fact that this one, I always thought that was interesting. Like, was it just sloppiness, or was somebody on vacation and somebody just filled in that time and used not only, no part, and used a Roman, not an Arabic numeral for the number? And it was always so different. Yeah. And that's never been done through any other series. So, yeah, that especially makes it jump out.
I would need to go check, but if I'm not mistaken, though, Redemption is the same way, isn't it? Isn't it Redemption 1, Redemption 2?
Oh, you may be right.
I think so. And then the rest of them are as we're describing. So I think that it was probably a case of during the Next Generation, depending on who the editor was or who was dealing with the titles, they handled it differently. This is me thinking as an editor because it's my job.
Although Redemption does, I just checked, Redemption does not have a row. It's just Redemption and then Redemption 2.
You're right. Yeah. It doesn't say 1, but then it says Redemption 2.
But Unification
2,
is Unification 1 and Unification 2. Yeah.
1 and 2.
But that's the only time Roman numerals
and then
used.
From that point on, from that point on, they actually get into it's consistent. Yeah.
Well, then, and you know, then DS9, as you well know, got into the whole thing about we're too cool to do Part 1 and Part 2. We'll just give different names to each half, which gave you twice as many titles to have to remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Except for the Maquis. The Maquis does have a part.
Well, see, that was before Ira was running the show. So there you go. That's Michael's.
Yeah. But I think it's the only one, though, in DS9.
That's what I'm saying. It was a Michael thing. Yeah. So, of course.
Even the Circle Trilogy, they have different names, you know, which comes before the Maquis. So anyway, now we're geeking out on titles. But this is obviously very intentional to use a Roman numeral 3 without a part. So there has to be a connection. I don't know what the connection is. I don't know if it's just Romulans and Vulcans. I don't know if somehow Spock
thematic.
Is going to get connected in some strange way. But loosely thematic. But there is an intentional connection.
Yeah, and maybe in 900 years, whether Romulans are involved or not, the thing that my gut feeling is, the founders are humans, Vulcans, Andorians, and those other guys we don't ever get to talk about, the Tellarites. But clearly, over the centuries, the Andorians kind of fall off in the power structure. But clearly, over the centuries, no one joins the Federation as a new species coming in to rival the power. You know, humans and then Vulcans right there. Mm-hmm. Nobody rivals that. So I'm just thinking part of this breakup is probably whether it was animosity, whether it was something structural or whatever, natural. Or political, whatever. The Vulcans are not part. Have we seen a Vulcan in any of these promos running around?
I haven't looked so closely.
I don't think there's been prominently. Yeah, I don't. But I don't think I've seen like a number three person in a scene or these gangs of. Not that you want to think the Vulcans are running around being, you know, but they could be. They have various, obviously, could be. Or whether they're Vulcans and Romulans. I've heard some Vulcans and Romulans over the years, even interspecies, and were birthed and were mistaken as good Starfleet people when they were actually Romulan moles. That actually happened across history. But my point here is whether the Vulcans and Romulans unified and were a member of the Federation for a while, or maybe unifying took the Vulcans out of the Federation, like has been threatened at times that we've seen. Or whether the Romulans have nothing to do with this, and it's purely just the Vulcans took their ball and left over a political or an organic split. Mm-hmm.
And whatever that happened, that's like at the core. Maybe that started the slide. Maybe that blew up things, and that was part of the burn era when the Federation started its slide and descent. And maybe this is getting, you know, it's almost like a retelling of the pre-Romulan War thing where they're all coming together for the first time in mutual defense. And maybe this is the, you know, halfway through the season is a good, which is where this episode falls, is a good time to, they've laid out enough of the backstory. They've taken two episodes just to get her back to her ship again. She's, we're watching Michael learn the lay of the land in this space and time. And then by the time she gets back to the crew, three or four, five, remember how far it was into season two before we started getting the details? We went from the glowy thing in the 5 points to this glowy, weird, angel-y suit to what is it really? Who made it? Who's in it? You know, those reveals. It was like halfway through the season, yeah. Two-thirds of the way. And we're chasing Spock at the same time. It was like halfway to...
I was thinking the Spock chase was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like halfway to... And that's where this falls in this season. So it's like if whatever the you know, the dystopia that's fallen here, that's like it feels like halfway through is the beginning of the turnaround. And maybe that's a if whether it happens or not or whether that's the first blow to getting back to it. It could just be totally a thematic thing. But that Roman numeral three out of the blue, you know,
yeah,
feels like Vulcans are involved somehow.
Yeah. And listening to you describe this and looking at the episode titles, one thing that comes to mind. Pure speculation at this point. I'm just on the fly here. People of Earth are the people I'm thinking, because I've been rewatching season two. So I'm thinking about the people who are in New Eden. Mm-hmm. And these people were rescued from Earth. Now, we don't know what's happened over 900 something years. Maybe people on Earth, maybe something's happened to Earth. Maybe there aren't people on Earth right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe the people who are on New Eden are somehow... That's like a refuge. We do have an episode in here called The Sanctuary. Maybe this is a refuge for humanity at this point. Mm-hmm. And forget me not, the Vulcans, maybe humans and Vulcans, who are by far the two most powerful founding members of the Federation, that's pretty well established in Star Trek, have been split apart somehow. Unification 3 could refer to humans and Vulcans being reunited.
Or starting the path.
Which allows the Federation to be reunited.
Yeah, or starting that way.
Or starting the path, to head down to that point. So it could be that something happened. And I'm also guessing that maybe over the course of 900 years, maybe the Romulans and the Vulcans did reunite. And if they reunited, 900 years is enough time for them to form an entirely new culture together, you know, as a unified species
plenty
again, which may be... especially considering the destruction of Romulus, maybe a very Vulcan culture, where the Romulans were largely assimilated into the Vulcan culture. And then at some point, we have the burn, the Vulcans and the humans get separated. And here, we need to reunify them in order to restore the Federation to its previous stature.
I mean, 930 years is seven. It's been 20 years now. But when we turned the corner in, you know, the Y2K, but when we turned to 2000 and people were all into, you know, it's not just a decade, a year or a decade or a century, it's a millennia. And we were all into the whole thing of millennia and 1,000 years. Well, 930 years is just 70 short of another millennia.
Yeah.
Right. So if we think about, you know, yes, life was slower paced. But if we think about the way our mindsets were about what the difference on the world, on Earth, between 1000 AD and 2000 AD, you know, when we were all kind of aware of that and reflecting on that, we're in that same kind of framework, not on the exact like 0 years, but it's 70 years short of another whole millennia. That's an awful lot, especially when you're talking about technological cultures, at least for a while before this burn. Think how much it's spent. We're thinking about Daniels and the temporal Cold War and the Enterprise J, was it? You know, and the spidery, you know, spindly little powerful ships that don't look like they're that rugged and tough, but they obviously are. And the time ships, you know, that we see, you know, their ships and everything about Braxton and all, everything we've had glimpses of over the years, that's all part of it. But that's not even as far as this. And we're talking about an acceleration curve on the tech and then that blowing up somehow. But was that just the Federation? And who are the other parties? And they're the things that were Federation members who went their separate ways. All those stars on the flag, something happened to them. Were they destroyed? Did they just go away and go back to, you know, take their ball and leave?
They fell off, Larry. They weren't Iron Dawn well enough. And they just fell off. They've been unfurling that flag too many times.
That's another
to show
book.
Off to people
they can.
And they,
that's
they fell
that's
off.
The stars we missed with MISS apostrophe D. That's, you know, to be poetic.
No, but what you're saying is true. And when you think about, okay, so from 1000 AD to 2000 AD, you think how the world changed, but think how the world has changed in the last 30 years.
Right.
Because of our
yes.
technology, and think how quickly it's changing now, just year to year, and what this century may be like. And once these societies become so technologically advanced, the level of change that can occur mm-hmm. over a year, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, really astonishing.
There's a snazzy sociological name for that. I can't remember what it is. But yes, it's about the pace of change accelerating the longer we're around, which is that mm-hmm. whole theoretical thing about civilizations. All, you know, like the reason we're not finding other space in real life now, not in Star Trek terms, but the reason we may right. not be finding other civil, if we're going to be arrogant enough to think we've done all we could, which we obviously were just in the baby steps of trying to contact other civilizations, even by radio or, you know, chemical and spectral wavelengths or something. But the reason yeah. we haven't found any other some kind of intelligent life forms is because no one ever gets that far in their maturity curve, in their technological development curve, because something always happens.
Yeah.
Either they do blow, like genes right. thing, they either blow themselves up or poison their worlds, or they just die out through, you know, natural, the asteroid catches up with them that hits their planet, you know, and they're a dinosaur. So it's like, maybe that's a thing. So yeah, all those things yeah. are in play.
Frederick Pohl wrote a great short yeah. story about that called Fermi and Frost, where... the story is about a nuclear war on Earth that wipes us out, but the speculation that this is what happens everywhere. Like mm-hmm. civilizations always destroy themselves.
Yeah.
They usually do, yeah.
And never get to the point where they've developed, they have to restart to get to the point where they're capable of galactic communication, much less galactic travel.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, okay, well, that's very interesting speculation on what this could all mean.
Discovery season and, 3, you say.
At this point.
That's going to find the sky, yeah.
At this point, we have very little to go on, but...
Well, we do have something. We do have some caveats here. We've got casting, we've got names of people involved, and yeah, which has been yeah. newsworthy.
Another thing I wanted to talk about, it relates to this idea of the Federation having... become a shadow of itself. You know, it was very powerful, and now it seems to be in a survival mode. It has very little influence in the galaxy. If you look at the day and age that we live in right now, and you look mm-hmm. at what's happening around the world, it really does feel like we are at a turning point in history where the nations that have influence in the world are changing. And this, of course, has happened many times in our history. I think people forget because we all kind of tend to think that we live in the chosen time and the way the world is today is normal, right? But if you look back at history, there have been many empires, many great civilizations mm-hmm. that have come and gone, left a little bit behind. Some of them are still around, have less influence. Some of them are gone completely. So it's just a normal part of time, the passage mm-hmm. of time and how societies operate. At the moment, we're seeing America go through a period of great turmoil, and we don't know which way it's going to go. I think back, you know, personally, I went to university at the end of the Cold War, and I actually was still in school, and I went to music school in Moscow, and it was still the Soviet Union. And as part of my degree program, I studied the Soviet political system. And, of course, Soviet history and Russian history and such. And
that's why you're in Japan, you commie. They wouldn't let you back home. Well, good riddance.
That's right. But it's interesting that, you know, at the time when I was growing up, especially like middle school, high school, we had the standoff. We had two great superpowers. We had the United States and we had the Soviet Union. And for me, because I was born into a situation where that was the norm.
Mm-hmm. Well, me too.
That just felt like that's how the world is. You know, yeah. there are these two great powers and they balance each other out and the other countries in the world choose to align themselves with one or the other. And then we saw the Soviet Union collapse.
Or be the non-aligned countries that nobody really cares about. Like the Indias, you know, right. And the, yeah, China trying to be. But yeah, a lot of Africa. Yeah.
Right. But we, but even like Africa, I mean, you know, Russia had great influence over Africa. Mm-hmm. And you go to Moscow, go to the medical schools in Moscow in the 90s. So many students there came from African countries. So there was, you know, they have different spheres of influence. But my point is, you feel like it's always going to be this way. But then you see the Soviet Union collapse rather quickly. Now, if you look back at the causes of it, it stretches back mm-hmm. over decades. And there were internal matters that were slowly eating away and led to that. But as an American, I remember thinking, okay, well, the Soviet Union's gone. But you don't think that that could happen to the United States. But now you look at what's happening and you start to worry. Okay, well, are we seeing another inflection point in history mm-hmm. where something's going to collapse? Now, I don't want to make this a discussion about the United States and what's going on there. But if you look at Discovery Season 3 and you look at the story, you could interpret it as the writers really commenting on what's happening in mm-hmm. the here and now. Mm-hmm. But you made a comment earlier, Larry, that's really important. A while ago, when you were talking about the timeline of production, and you mentioned that, well, they were filming this from like July 2019 into February of this year. Of course, they were writing it before that. The seeds of the story came before that. So in terms of kind of instability in American society, that was there. If you think of the burn as some kind of parallel for a galactic pandemic like coronavirus, this was all written before the coronavirus emerged. Mm-hmm. So that's coincidental. However, the average person, especially people who aren't diehard fans, who are reading all of the background from the writers and such and knowing the timelines, would look at this and think, oh, those damn Star Trek writers, they're trying to get all political on us again, and they're spoiling my Star Trek. I saw several comments over the past week about how that's what's being done. I saw some people who say they're huge fans lashing out at actors from Star Trek about how they're ruining the franchise. They're ruining the legacy of Star Trek by getting political. But of course, Star Trek's always been about social commentary, and often that intersects with politics. Mm-hmm. It has to. It's natural. So if we look at the setup of this story, I mean, what kind of parallels do you see? How much do you think might be intentional? How much is just general, this is how human society works and history kind of repeats itself, and Star Trek and science fiction tries to warn us about human nature and tries to help us find a way through all of that?
Right. Well, again, they started filming in July of 2019. They wrapped just about the time the coronavirus, the pandemic was imploding. It was a couple, you know, China was happening in December and January. They've wrapped here in February 24th, mm-hmm. and all the big shutdowns were hitting the states in the middle of March, basically, right around St. Patrick's Day, I remember, in the week before that. And then, of course, yeah, like I said, the writing was all months before that. So, yes, it wasn't on the nose a commentary about coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic, but whatever your allegory, whatever your metaphor here is for a big shakeup, and whether it's your fault, maybe it's a thing about climate change, and maybe they were trying to make a statement about climate change, and maybe the burn was a slow motion set of dominoes falling that then hit a critical mass point, and then everything happened. And a lot, you know, the it's like climate change is the pandemic only times 1,000 in slowness, or the pandemic is it's things going viral, but instead of like actual viruses, it's like all these interrelated elements that are happening. And then, but at one point they hit a critical mass to where they're all interacting, and it's just mm-hmm. not as obvious or as limited mm-hmm. as a simple virus bug, which can be really deadly and very damaging. But it's like one thing we're watching, mm-hmm. one kind of thing, where you're talking about all kinds of points with climate change, and maybe it starts off so slow that people miss it, or people can debate it, or they argue about it, and then by the time it happens, it's too late to turn the corner back. And that could have been the allegory for the burn, actually. And now it's just that the pandemic is like climate change on steroids as far as speed and damage potential, you know, and now we're going to make it on a galactic scale. So, but yeah, we're in a time when everything is heightened, and these Star Trek writers, look, it's not just that these writers, I think, I don't want to say they're all activists, because they're all a whole spectrum of people coming from different backgrounds and different genres they enjoy and their personalities and all that coming through. And nobody likes to be accused of like anything being on the nose, right? Whether it's design or it's writing. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was just sitting here thinking about was we talk about what Gene and Dorothy did in the 60s. And a lot of people today would say, well, these things are so on the nose with their politics. Gene, yeah, they talked about social issues, but they weren't dragging things out of the headlines of the day to make this, you know, like direct reference that just hits you over the head. It's because they couldn't, because they still had censors and they had advertisers. Mm-hmm. They had all the economic forces that were about them. They had to be, if they were going to be subversively progressive, they had to be subversive in a really guarded way. And they still pushed the envelope and they still got away with things. And Gene still had art, even when he wasn't hands on, he was still getting fights with the network. And that's the whole thing of the ratings, Mark Cushman's gotten into with his books. Many times they won their time slot. Even in the third season, they were winning. They were first or second in their time slot on a par that other shows that got renewed. It's just that Gene wore out his welcome with NBC and was fighting so many battles. I'm amazed that he still tried to keep pitching shows to them. It's like, who would work with him by that point? That's what it's the same reason as saying, oh, look at these crappier ships, you know, in the 60s. It's unless you go at it the way they did for Trials and Tribulations, where they said, well, now we're going to show detail on the station. We're going to show detail on the Enterprise that we didn't see just because of our camera, you know, our perceived camera storytelling distance. You go back to the time it was made in, and those factors are what's, it's not intrinsically something of the show. They would have pushed the envelope further with the storytelling. Again, not that anybody wants to be on the nose. Now you've got a documentary, or now you're doing a historical piece. But if you're trying to tell, you know, narrative ideas that illuminate issues of your time, the way we always talk about Star Trek, you know, being a pioneer of, and that's so beloved for doing the metaphors and the theme shows and the issue shows, they're limited still by advertisers and censors. Then today, that's like not in play. They're being encouraged to push that. We're talking about the casting of trans and binary characters. They're making up a lot of lost ground,
especially since we've shifted to streaming services.
That's what
like
I'm saying.
CBS All
the
Access.
Streaming subscription, yeah, the whole exactly. change in the business model has let this writing happen. And I know a lot of people say, it's just not the same. I could read things between the lines and interpret, you know, it was like a work of art that everybody takes the same way. And a lot of people feel like maybe this is a little on the nose. A lot of other people feel like this is what we knew was happening all along. It's just now they're freer to talk about it. So it's like the same way. Do we want to go back to that kind of a TV, a small screen media? Do we want to go back to more inefficient cars? Do we want to go back to more, you know, do we want to go back to things that could, it's still an amazing storytelling vehicle. This, you know, Star Trek, the original series especially, is still, you know, and those limitations were still around Next Generation. Classically, David Gerald trying to tell his allegory for AIDS and involving, you know, gay characters, either on the nose or by metaphor. Or, you know, all the gender issued stories along the way, that were trying to make those statements and go there, as well as other issues too. But, you know, this is the first time we've been so unbounded. We're unbound by format. If you want to tell a 3-hour story and do the whole thing on Andoria's number 3 planet, then go and do that. You know, if you want to go over here and do this kind of a thing for a limited number of episodes, you can. If you want to tell a 15-minute thing and go be experimental, you can do that. And that's part of the freedom now, but part of the other freedom is doing these things. And again, not to go in and wallow in something, but to just have that freedom where you're not worrying that your advertiser, who's the cigarette guy, is still screaming at you because your characters aren't smoking cigarettes or you know, whatever. That you can actually have a Vietnam allegory that somehow gets right past everybody and gets on the air and none of the suits and censors realized it. Now you don't have that layer.
Yeah, you have a lot more freedom now. And when I look at it, like, I think, again, I've been rewatching a lot of stuff lately. And there are stories where I've heard people talk about how this element of this story or that story, it's, mm-hmm. as you're saying, too on the nose. It's just they have a political agenda and they're trying to push this. And
I mean, freedom is a big responsibility. It's like a director who's his own editor. Some director writes and directs his own movie, and it's one of these 2.5 hour monsters that anybody else who had to succumb to a producer or an authority would have had them, hone it down to 2 hours slightly under.
Right.
That freedom is a lot of responsibility, and nobody wants to be accused of just, being too on the nose.
Yeah.
You lose the art of it then too.
My interpretation of a lot of this, though, is that when I watch these things and I really think about them, and especially when you rewatch and you pick up on the lines and you pay a little bit more attention to a specific line or a specific element of the story, there's a lot being read into things that is not the intention of the writer. It's not the intention of the story. It's the personal interpretation based on how you feel about a political topic, mm-hmm. or what you see as an agenda being pushed on you by someone else for whatever reason. And it's not really there in the story, but it's being interpreted that way. So I think that's a lot of when we hear a lot of the noise, especially on social media, I think that's where it is coming from. But it also makes it very easy for some of these stories such as this to be interpreted that way. And one interesting thing that was said here about The Burn by Kurtzman in some recent panels is that, like, we think of it, and we've been talking about it here, like, something happened and the Federation went into decline, maybe gradually it went into decline because that's what's happened to some civilizations in our own history. Kurtzman said, what happened to the Federation didn't happen because the Federation collapsed mm-hmm. in on itself because of disagreement or strife. That's not what happened. The Federation was as strong as ever. Obviously, something cataclysmic went down that changed everything. And so that supports more of what you're talking about,
where
various elements came together.
Whatever. It's external, not internal.
Right. Yeah. Versus what I suggested, which is that it could be read as a parallel for what's mm-hmm. happening right now, where internally in the United States right now, and I'm speaking from someone who's outside and I'm looking in, so of a different point of view. Mm-hmm. As an observer, we see globally, we see this deterioration happening, which I think may be more difficult to see from the inside, but from the outside, right. You're watching this deterioration happen. He's saying that's not what has happened to the Federation. Federation was fine, stronger than ever. Suddenly this thing happened, the burn. And when that happened, and that's why when he says that was the day the galaxy took a hard left, I think that is using the expression take a hard left in its simplest meaning mm-hmm. of life changed.
Right.
Everything changed because this huge event. But because we're so right and left in terms of political discussion and everything's political these days, the interpretation here is that politically, the Federation drastically changed. But I don't think that that is the intention here.
Yeah. And we're focusing on the event here. Part of how we'll, it's like everything else in Star Trek. It's like modern Star Trek storytelling. All this background is going to, think how slowly the five lights, the red angel, the suit, what the mechanics were, who was inside. They peel. That's part of the serialized storytelling. They peel those layers back a little bit mm-hmm. at a time. You get a little more reveal each episode, the mystery, the clues. And there's hopefully two or three things going on at once where it's not just this, straight line, lineal plot. There's at least a mm-hmm. B and a C story hopefully happening through all this, even if it is serialized. And then maybe incidental stories per episode, whatever. But we're going to learn beyond these first, and they'll give us a few more crumbs between, well, we're about to start unraveling this now. It's not 6 months down the line. We're here. So we're going to start getting it in real time. We're going to get the clues a bit at a time. And again, to me, the metaphor is how last season's plot unwound. But it's all going to come at us through the eyes of the Discovery, through Burnham on her own, and then the Discovery crew separated. And then when they're all together again, they're going to get all these bits and pieces. They've got people of the, they've got the Federation of 3187, what's left of it, to tell them things up front. Now, whether everything that we see them learn, you know, the exposition coming out, whether that all comes at them or they start to find, or there somebody is holding back telling them, or they tell them everything. Oh, here's what happened. You know, in one long scene, we get somebody talking about this happened, the burn on this date, these years. Oh, you know, you can't believe what all you guys lost out on. Here's what's happened. The story so far, as they say on Monty Python. Whether that will unravel a little bit of time or whether we get bang that all at once, I don't know. I don't know how the story is going to develop, but we're going to get, this Discovery crew is going to get it the same way we do, right? The characters are going to hear it the same way we do. So it's not just about the event. It's not just about the burn and what caused it. We're going to hear the immediate reaction. How far back from this landing time did it happen? Just in the last 100 years? Did it happen in the last 200 years? We're going to get that.
Right. Yeah.
And we're going to learn about what the immediate reaction to it was. The thing happened. And then what? The Vulcans left? What? How are there only 8 stars on that flag? What exactly happened? Was it a multitude of, like, one simple thing happened and it reverberated out and had all kinds of different ripple effects? Or was it one big massive ripple effect that affected everybody the same way? But then we're going to see how our Discovery crew reacts to it. If they're fairly uniform, if they're divided, if they're diversified, if some of the, you know, and all these people they're meeting in this time, do they pick up allies? They're apparently going to pick up a couple. Some of the recent casting, you know, we haven't talked about people yet, but these new roles and David Ayala. Oh, it's Mr. Ayala, the real one, only with a J, not a Y. We're going to see how they've reacted and how they pass that along. So part of this whole thing is not just the event, it's the reactions, and it's by who and what stage and when. And I say all that because part of what will separate this out from being an on-the-nose allegory or metaphor for modern life, whatever it is going to be not just the event itself, but the reaction and the way and the points of view and the reactions to it. And if we see either the people of that time, like David Ayala's character Book and some of the other new characters we're talking about, Blue DeBarrio and Ian Alexander's characters, Ken Mitchell, I'll spoil it, is coming. No, not really. They've announced it. Ken Mitchell is coming, who'd played Klingon and who had been diagnosed with ALS and is using a wheelchair now. Mm-hmm. He's back playing a human of some kind. Maybe it's a view screen. Maybe they're incorporating a wheelchair, whatever. And I know I'm getting ahead into casting, but we've got these characters of people who are obviously of the time. We're going to see their points of view, their reactions to this, where they're coming from. And ours. And all of that is going to reflect on this metaphor or not for reflecting on today's times that was written 2 years ago, as much as the actual event itself, the burn, the inciting incident. So, as we're sitting here talking, it's like, it's not just about what they chose to represent the big disruption. It's about now we're going to see the immediate and then our guys' reaction to how it is as metaphors and parallels to today, too.
Yeah, I think the burn will be a minor element. We'll find out what it was, but the story likely will not focus on the burn. We're just going to learn what caused it, what the trigger was. But as you say, yeah, the story will be about the aftermath and how it affects. It's interesting to think about our characters coming from the past and the characters who are native to this time frame and how they see the situation. That's actually, it's a really smart way to tell a story. We're not just telling the story from the point of view of the people living in the time, but we have people from two different time periods, drastically different time periods, and also people from the Federation when it was strong versus the Federation as it is now.
Well, that's, part of the, you see them talking that way. Oh, like you're like ghosts, and are they inspiration? It's like instead of unraveling, you know, unfreezing Khan and his followers, you've unfrozen George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, mm-hmm. and Mahatma Gandhi, and, you know, who name 5, 10, you know, it's like the 37s, yeah. only they're all, you know, they're all the celebrities, not just the little people.
And then there's going to be this one guy that says the burn was an inside job.
Right. Yeah. It didn't really happen.
Yeah. But okay, so talking about characters and also sticking with the idea of some fans feeling like, why is Star Trek being political and getting upset about it? One of the big bits of news about Star Trek Discovery 3 is the fact that we're going to have the first binary and transgender mm-hmm. main cast members on the show, main characters. This news came out and I saw some people go, no, you know, we've had so-and-so. And I'm like, okay, you're kind of missing the point, guys. It's not trivia that there was a one-off character in the past. That's not the point. The mm-hmm. point is that we have actual characters who are integral to the story on an ongoing basis for the season, a binary character and a transgender character. So you mentioned Blue Del Barrio a bit earlier. They're playing a character named Adira, mm-hmm. who is said to bond with Stamets and Culber. And then we also have Ian Alexander, who is a transgender character named Gray.
But then they also say is a Trill host candidate who apparently has not hosted a symbiont, but was in training or wanting to be a host. And then something right. happens to disrupt that. So maybe the burn is yeah. what disrupts it. Maybe, you know, we see a lot of Trill in the, you know, we see the pools. We see the symbiote pool. We see whether it's Trills, like I said, or it's off on some colony world. But we see a lot of Trills mm-hmm. in this. So, you know, whether they're back home or that's a colony world far flung or whatever. So it's not like he's all on his own. It's like he can't be a symbiont because he's the last of his kind or something. Or maybe something's happened to the symbionts, or maybe that's some threat. Maybe they're using that. But it's interesting to me how they say they've made a... Maybe they're just writing press releases and marketing language to 2020 audience, assuming 95% of the world has no clue what the Trill were. Or maybe this is some kind of wrinkle because maybe it's a commentary on, look, if we look at the Trill hosts and even the non-Trill hosts, Jadzia always talked about herself as a mother or a father, a man or a woman, you know, like whether, you know, Curzon mm-hmm. or any of the other Trill, you know, well, the hosts, the Dax symbiont is the symbiont. So if they're talking about Gray is his character name, if Gray is a symbiont mm-hmm. and they're thinking about the symbionts as being trans, or if they're talking about the host humanoid Trill host being that way, or host wannabe candidate. I'm a little confused there, or if they're just saying trans to describe the whole Trill system to an audience that may not be familiar. Or maybe I'm being very clunky yeah. about this and I'm overthinking it. I don't know. But that was a curiosity to me.
I don't
know if this is something slightly different, or it's the time post-burn, or if it's just their promotion department talking about it this way.
I don't know if it's... There hasn't been enough information revealed for me to really say for sure.
Right.
So I'm just... Right. Looking at it the way you are, I'm not sure. The Trill, it's a good idea to use the Trill mm-hmm. in this situation because the Trill are a species where, as the host, the host is male or female, as portrayed on TV in the past anyway.
We've seen so far. I mean, there could be trans hosts.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying.
Exactly.
Is this actually
yeah,
a
could.
New wrinkle for
so
the Trill?
So we don't know.
Yeah.
But where I'm going with this is just what we've known in the past. So what we've seen in the past, when you think about DS9, we've had male and female Trill who host a symbiont who, if the host is male or the host is female, they identify that way. And I'm not an expert on any of this, and I'm not trying to offend anyone, please. You know.
I was going
to
say, I'm sure I'm like clunking my way into this too.
Yeah. So I'm not presenting this as an expert in any way because I don't know and I have no intention to offend anybody. And I think that's one reason it's great that they're going to have this, because I think we'll all learn a lot more mm-hmm. about gender identity through this season of Star Trek Discovery. It's just the way that I've seen it on Star Trek Deep Space Nine is that I never got the impression that the symbiont had a strong gender mm-hmm. identity, but the host did.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a byproduct of needing to cast human beings
right.
who are either, at least as we see them, male or female, right? So the whole idea here is very interesting. And I think the Trill as a species is the perfect choice to explore this area of identity and gender identity. So I'm very interested to see what they do with it.
And it gives Discovery a chance, especially if they're talking about a vastly different time period, but it gives an anchor for the audience that does know, you know, something to, if they're not inventing a whole new species situation. They're going with the Trills. So.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And there's always sort of been that question, like when you watch Jadzia, you think about, well, what is the relationship and what is, how does gender play out in Trill society? And here they're going to explore that more. So it's sort of a continuation of an idea that was introduced during a very different social period in Star Trek. And now they're going to explore it today, almost 30 years later, when we have a very different, widely accepted view of gender identity in society. And now they can explore that more. See, that's where I think people say, well, oh, Star Trek, don't get all political on us and don't be too...
SJW.
You know, don't push the boundaries of social concepts on us so much. But that's actually what Star Trek has done. It's just that the time period in which the episodes are written really dictates how they approach the episodes.
Hindsight's wonderful, as we always say. Right.
Exactly. Is what I'm saying. So this is interesting. And I was also thinking about the Trill, knowing that this was written quite a while back. If they had the idea that they were going to use the Trill in this way in the third season of Discovery, might that be a reason why we see so many Trills popping up on Picard or Lower Decks? Just here and there. It's just sort of like getting you accustomed to the idea, especially a new audience that doesn't know all the back history, that didn't watch DS9, of, oh, there's this race called the Trill. Like visually you go, oh, I know that race. I've seen them. They were in here. Right. I saw them there.
Well, but they haven't
just be dropping them in, kind of.
I don't know if it was a conscious effort because there's been no real, I mean, Trills have been background dressing, but there's not been a real major character be a Trill or had a major story point associated with Trillness or being a, you know, the whole thing of carrying a Trill symbiote.
Yeah.
It's been mentioned once or twice, but you know, it's to someone who's a new fan, it's just kind of like, oh, and then those guys have dots up and down their sides of their face and neck. You know, it's.
But then when you see this character, you go, oh, okay. I know, you know, this isn't something new. This is like an actual race that's been around as part of the Federation. So I don't know. It's just something that popped in my head because I was wondering, like, why are we seeing so many Trills lately?
And you know what? It's a tricky thing when you haven't, when so much of a season has been filmed, or even when it hasn't, in a traditional, you know, the old school production setting where they'd start shooting in, you know, they're writing when they start shooting in May or June, and then the premiere is in September, and they've got a backlog, and then they come, it comes time to do the promotional material for the premiere. You've got the pilot. And then you've got two or three or four, but if the pilot has having a lot of visual effects spent and makeup, you know, and costume and sets, they kind of, you know, the early promotion for a series pulls a lot out of the pilot usually. And maybe the first or second episode, especially you're talking about post-production, whether they had time to fix or, you know, get together, whether they had time to assemble. But the point is, in hindsight, we all go back and look at all the lead up promotion videos and commercials for anything, Farpoint, for Emissary, for whatever. And you go, oh, yeah, everything is like out of the pilot's plot, right? So we keep seeing all these Trills, and I wonder if these are all the introductory scenes for Gray, for Ian Alexander's character, or if it's really like a lot of action and a lot of scene and screen time of all these Trills all through at least more than one episode, or is this all just part of the big splash when we, you know, when he comes into the storyline? Anyway, you know, who knows? But it's just something to throw out there. We're watching all those scenes and go, wow, there's a lot of Trill activity going on. And it may all be for like one 10-minute scene in the pilot, and we don't get all that later on. It's all just, he's the, you know, we introduce Trills in him, and then after that it's, he, you know, it's carried by him and maybe one or two other characters he interacts with, but it's not this Discovery Season 3, the Trill Saga, which we obviously know it's not.
Yeah, we don't know for sure what's going on here. And his story may be parallel to what's happening to the Discovery crew, because mm-hmm. obviously their lives have taken an unexpected turn. They have to deal with what's going on. And as CBS has said in information about this character, his lifelong dream was to be a troll host,
but
he will have to adapt when his life takes an unexpected turn.
Yes. So, they're vague speaking a press release for a premiere of a show. Yes. His life takes an unexpected turn.
So we will see there.
Here's the thing that I don't know where this might fit in our discussion, but I wish, in hindsight, it feels like forever. They started working on this series in 2015, 2016, and the actors were cast. And they started shooting finally like in early 2017 and premiered in September 2017. But if you think about them as actual people and these seasons, we know season one led right into season two, right? And we don't know quite the, well season three is going to be continue right up from where we left, you know, the Red Angel suit and Discovery mm-hmm. going their own ways. It's all right. going to be continuous. But looking at Michael, plus everyone on Discovery that chose to make the trip, look at what's happened to them for the last 2 years. They were the craziness about being on this experimental ship that could do these insane things that was top secret in the day, in the middle of a war that the Klingons were winning on Earth's doorstep. But before they could help end the war, they're thrown into this wacky mirror universe, and then they're jerked out of it. They all face death all the time. Several of their members do die. They barely, by the skin of their teeth and the best of Starfleet intentions, talk down everybody to come up with this creative peace solution that actually helps one faction of Klingons. Maybe, you know, they're barely saying their prayers over that and taking a breather from that, you know, roller coaster ride, to then this whole thing with red lights pops up in Spock, and it starts off as just a ship to ship wacky, you know, mission transfer, becomes this whole saga where it winds up that, you know, again, breathlessly being whipsawed around, they all volunteer crazily to be in this battle with an AI that almost takes over their culture, their government, and their way of life and their local space. And they barely survive that encounter, which is even scarier than other people from another government in their own ships having a war, hot war with us. This is even weirder and scarier. And the way to win that battle is to take off and go 930 years halfway across the galaxy. And then they're kind of come out of that and they're giving up, you know, they're not just risking their lives. They're giving up any chance of having a normal life and going and plunging into this. And they all do it. My point is as we start this year, they have been like, it's like, forget the inertial dampers. They've been like on the bridge flung around for like 2 years. I mean, the emotional pounding mm-hmm. they've taken and jerked around is insane. Are we going to actually see that written into, gosh, at least Saru and Tilly and Culber and Stamets and, you know, the rest of them, Jet, I mean, all of them. And then much less the bridge crew, all the rest of them we barely know. I hope they develop them. Is that going to be part of the timbre, or is it all just going to be focused on the crisis in front? And that's just a finesse of writing. But I wish there were ways as mm-hmm. they go through these, what's in front of them now, the crisis of the moment and the obstacles to overcome. I hope they can inflect some of this insane ride they've been on for 2 straight years where they've barely gotten a breather. You know what I'm saying? I don't know if that'll be part of this or not, because the thing about the serialized storytelling is, you know, the whole thing about surprises and reveals, and maybe they're getting how to handle that down. It was better, much better with Picard. Of course, it's different people writing. The ultimate supervision is still Heather Caden and Kurtzman and a couple other people who are common, maybe mm-hmm. Akiva Goldsman. But there's a learning curve to that with these characters, with Star Trek, not just streaming serialized shows, but this franchise and these people. Maybe it's getting better and better and better. You know, Picard was definitely a step up. I'm hoping it is, but I hope that somehow we get a feeling, maybe in an off-character moment, somebody talks about these last 3 years have been insane, you know, kind of thing, where it's not just mm-hmm. what's in front of them right now. Hopefully they get a breather to talk about that. Anyway, that was 2 cents that's been bugging me all along, because in real life, it's been, you know, it's been 5 years since they started writing Discovery and 2 years since they were writing season two. But for these guys, it's all happened just within, you know, a span of 24 months, 30 months.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that'll happen, Larry, but I do know that everything you just described, that's the reason that Ron Emanuel Docent Jr. wants a transfer off the Vancouver, because he just wants to have like a normal life where it's not life and death like every moment.
I just want to know where they got that name. We can talk about that next time we talk. I just want to know some of these names. I'm like, Ron Docent. I'm just like, tell me that was like your best friend in the fifth grade, Mike. Tell me, you know. Anyway, that's Lord X.
Yeah. But no, I get what you're saying. And it's one of those things that I think about all the time with Star Trek is that these people, most of us have a couple of things that happen throughout our life mm-hmm. that are really traumatic moments. That
if not life-changing.
We really...
Yeah, in some way.
Right. That we have a few moments that really change our life or really feel like it's life or death or the end of the world throughout our whole life. But when we watch Starfleet officers, it's just continuous. Mm-hmm. It must be incredibly stressful for them. So, and particularly in the case of Discovery, because when you look at the star dates, it is just nonstop for these people. All right. Well, let's return back for a moment to the characters, because we talked about Ian Alexander's character, mm-hmm. who is the Trill, named Gray. I did want to point out
Gray?
That
what a,
Ian Alexander, well, yeah, that's what I was thinking when I was thinking about the name, but Ian Alexander is a 19-year-old actor who uses they, mm-hmm. them, and he, him pronouns. And I just want to mention that because it is very important in this discussion about gender. So those are the pronouns that Ian uses, they, them, and he, him. And Alexander is a big advocate for transgender mm-hmm. equality, for racial justice and mental health awareness, for LGBTQ plus youth, and is also the first transgender Asian American person to act on television. And that, along with, let's talk about Blue DeBario, who is a non-binary actor who uses the pronouns mm-hmm. they, them. And Blue DeBario will be playing the non-binary character, Adira, which we don't know much about,
right. That's about
at this
it.
Point, other than, as I mentioned earlier, Will Bond with Stamets and Culber. But one of the big topics that you hear brought up in the past few years is the practice of having actors play non-binary mm-hmm. or transgender or homosexual characters who they themselves are not of that identity, which of course makes sense that you would want someone, like if you're going to have a non-binary character, it's wonderful to have a non-binary actor portraying that character. And again, I don't want to delve too much into this because it's not my area of expertise, and I definitely don't want to step on anyone's toes or offend anybody with my lack of knowledge about the topic. But what I'm happy to see in Star Trek is that they are taking these steps to make sure that if they are going to portray a transgender character or a non-binary character, they're also casting actors who they themselves are non-binary or transgender, which is how it should be. And so I think that's a case where Star Trek is living up to its responsibility as a vehicle for social mm-hmm. commentary and social change in their casting practices as well as their writing.
Yeah, well, for anybody who's, you know, gritting their teeth over this, it's an outgrowth of an awareness and a sensitivity. And it's also financial. I mean, there are lots of actors... I mean, what I'm trying to get to is we go back to when, you know, John Wayne played Genghis Khan or, you know, Mickey, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's is such a wonderfully whimsical movie with Audrey Hepburn. But then you've got Mickey Rooney's horribly stereotypical, you know, playing of an Asian man. I forget whether he's Chinese or Japanese, supposedly, but he's, you know, doing the whole, you know, the eye thing with the glasses. And it's like... It's not just the characters, but it's the fact that they were. And we have that controversy now. We have all these characters and all the superhero and the graphic novels, you know, being made onto film. And we've had these controversies about, about, you know, white actors and actresses, but actors playing these roles of color. And sometimes there's been an uproar mm-hmm. and the actors were like, oh, I didn't even think about that. I'm going to bow out gracefully. Or sometimes there's been a pressure campaign to get, or sometimes they go ahead and don't. And then there's like a backlash against that movie being made or whatever the project is. And, you know, that's right. You know, all those, you know, Leonard Nimoy played, you know, Indians and all the Westerns back in the day when they were just really kind of breathlessly ugh on a lot of factors.
Yeah.
They weren't all, you know, Bonanza and Gunsmoke. And in the movies, too, you had tons of white men, you know, just smear on the darker red makeup, especially in black and white. Who cared? You know, or if they, you know, Ricardo Montalban, if you had some kind of exotic features playing, 1 minute they're playing an Arab, 1 minute they're playing an Israeli, 1 minute they're playing a Native American, only to say that mm-hmm. on top of you kind of people at the time, you know, it kind of added to the facelessness of those people, especially if it was just background Indians to get shot off a horse, you know, whatever. But if they were halfway a decent character role, you're also talking about how many actors were out there that they were taking that job from, right? And it's not like some of the actors, some white actors, mainstream actors, known actors, see that as an affront to their talent to be able to play a diversity of roles, which they think they'd like to think they're trained mm-hmm. to do. I'll just go research. Mm-hmm. That's part of what the acting mindset is. But it's also the thing mm-hmm. of casting being open to, look, you've got this huge pool of talent. Why not? If you're not, it's not going to be a case of we're going to have the all female cast of The Odd Couple or the all black cast of The Odd Couple. I mean, if you're not doing a novel concept kind of thing, or you're trying to make something like Shakespeare more universal, you know, the universality of it by doing that, or you're just having non-gender, mm-hmm. as you see all the time now, the two Star Treks in the park that were in Portland and Seattle were totally non-gender based. You had women playing or trans characters playing, you know, either way, going back and forth and just making those characters. Mm-hmm. And you see mm-hmm. artwork reflecting that too. So in the world of just trying to get the essential truths of the characters, the quote unquote realistic casting, that's all over the scale now. But we've come to a point now where that was unheard of. It's not even hyper-realistic because you had whites playing Indians and Western. But again, taking away those talent pools to not even be considered. And it's not just about the portrayal on the screen. It's getting the casting. As you see a lot of times now, people of color, women, whatever it is that's been underrepresented on film, and that talent pool not being able to have a career because of the things, you know, the PowerPoints in the industry, TV and movies, and online now, and game casting, people not being open or even having it on their radar to even be aware to think in those terms. So this is a whole issue that's been evolving. And, you know, it's like other parts of social justice. We've gone from just thinking about gender, you know, male binary gender, male, female, and then race, to all the ramifications of that, and then all the gender issues and the whole spectrum of all of that. So it's not like this is radically different. This is just the latest chapter of, you know, and I'll admit to being ignorant about all kinds of things until somebody puts it in my face and I go, oh, okay, I get it. You know, and I can't hope to, especially at this age, I can't hope to have, that's what a lot of those people say. Yes, you're a very talented actor, actress, but it's not just a matter of going and doing some research or traveling somewhere and staying with them for a week or two. There are so many nuances to an experience that you haven't lived that there's, no offense, but there's no way you can live enough to bring it to the acting demand that this role needs in this story. And that's where a lot of that is. And, you know, so anyway, just as a sidebar to that, for people that are kind of feeling like they're whipsawed, every moment in history, if we keep progressing, every moment in time has been a whipsaw of, oh, really? Just putting black actors into movies and TV shows and doing something besides being porters and maids was kind of a whipsaw for a point.
Right.
You know, just by people with blinders on. So much less being more aggressive in that. Anyway.
Well, it's a progression of society and how people learn more and learn to be more accepting. And entertainment can drive that. And Star Trek has driven that over time. And I think this is another situation where Star Trek is pushing things forward once again. And I think the season of Discovery will be a great opportunity for many of us to learn mm-hmm. more about these people, these characters, these ways of identifying that we're not familiar with personally. And it's a great addition to the show for that reason. Mm-hmm. And Discovery has done a wonderful job in its first two seasons of delivering diversity and acknowledging diversity and inclusion. And I think this is just another step in that. So it's going to be an interesting part of the show this year.
Yes, yes.
Well, Larry, we are getting close to 2 hours. And when we started, we were joking on the other side of the room that I'm not sure how much we have to say about the third season since we don't know that much about what's coming up. But as usual, you and I have talked for 2 hours.
Well, it was that hour we spent on Janeway coming to...
I guess so.
Maybe not an hour. Okay.
But to wrap up with some final yes. thoughts and maybe anything we want to see about season three in terms of just maybe the creative element of Discovery that we haven't talked about yet. Do you have anything?
Yeah. Well, I just real quickly, because there's not a lot to get into, but just I just feel, again, very excited for the parameters of the season being lifted. You know, they feel freedom to go places and not be affected. But it's obvious by the visuals we've seen, they're making a big point to get back to, I say, Federation in quotes, who knows what they are now by this time, all these familiar faces of species and member races that we've seen, and they've made a really big effort from what I've seen to really do a good match. Maybe they update the technology just on something like, again, Andorians and Lurians like Morn and some of the other species, Cardassians we've seen in some of those bits. The visuals, I think they feel the freedom, but at the same time, they're really making an effort to try to tie in more. That's one of the big criticisms about the visuals of Discovery, being a little lost in the yeah. freedom of a new time and not thinking how to merge both needs of new technology, new creatives, but also keeping a visual continuity with the past. The other thing that's exciting is a lot of the names that have been with the show so far are writing. The most of the scripts have the writers out here listed. So Michelle Paradise is back as a showrunner. And Jenny Lumet and Alex Kurtzman, they wrote the season premiere. But also Sean Cochran, who's been a junior member of the writing staff, who's come up the ranks since the first season. He's one of the survivors of the first season. Erica and Boye are writing, even though they're going to be the showrunners of Section 31. Some of the other writers that have been involved before. I mentioned Kirsten already on Unification. But some of the other names that have been in and out, Alan McElroy, who has been involved with Halloween 4, Wrong Turn. He's really worked a lot with Todd McFarlane on the Spawn franchise. There's that. Kenneth Lynn, who's a playwright, written several plays. Kleptocracy is one I know. But he worked on House of Cards, The Warrior on Cinemax. Another writer, Kalinda Vasquez, worked on Prison Break and Nikita. So, you know, there's some of the names on the writing staff that, whether they're on staff technically or they're third-party writers that are writing, some of the newer names mm-hmm. have some good, you know, impressive writing credentials too. So that's exciting to see. And as some of the directors are new, but Jonathan's got 3 different episodes he's directing. Olatunde Osamsami, Tundi as they like to call him, he's directed the first 2 out of the gate that have scenes shot in Iceland. And the season, he's down for the season finale, at least as far as we know. And some other new directors coming in and some coming back. But anyway, I'm excited for the creative mix to that extent. Looks like it's in good hands.
Good. Well, I hope that some of them do what one of my big wishes is, and that is to get the whole bridge crew more involved in the story.
Yes, yes.
Because I was rewatching season 2 again to get ready for season 3, and I was reminded once again how early in the season, through the first maybe 4 episodes or so, I really thought, oh, we're going to start getting bridge characters involved. We're going to get to know the crew. But then it all fizzled out. Mm-hmm. And I really want to see a show where we have, especially the bridge crew, because the bridge crew should be integral to what you're doing with the story. And I want to see Saru take the captain's chair and... I want to see, but I don't think we're going to get it, especially not looking at the lineup of episodes that we have here. I want to see more episodes like New Eden in season 2, mm-hmm. which feel more like standalone, that do tie into the story, but they have more of that classic Star Trek feeling. But I think that for that, I'm going to have to wait for Strange New Worlds because mm-hmm. I don't really see a whole lot in here.
I agree with you. Yeah.
That might give us that.
Heading to New Eden.
But overall, I'm very optimistic about the season because the premise is very interesting. It seems like it's very clearly going to be, at least on the A story, one long story where each episode is like a chapter. It looks like it might be a bit more unified than the second season was, because I felt like the second season fizzled out once we got to the episode called The Red Angel, when we mm-hmm. found out who the Red Angel was. I felt like that should have been more towards the end. We still had a lot to go after that. But the story, the concept sounds really interesting, and I like the visuals that we're seeing, and we're going to get to see, as you said, a lot of races that we're familiar with from past Star Trek that we haven't seen so far in Discovery. And there's a lot of opportunity for character growth here. I think Burnham's likely to change quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Sonequa Martin-Green's already mentioned that her character is no longer governed by fear, which I think is more of a reference to the kind of hardship that she went through the first two seasons. So that'll be interesting. And I think, you know, Saru, I just finished watching An Obel for Karen and The Sound of Thunder in the second season. Mm-hmm. And they really kind of opened the door for Saru as a character. And now they've put him in a situation where, you know, he has a lot of opportunity for growth. So those are the things that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah. And I just underline what you said about the bridge crew. And I'm thinking of Detmer and Wosikin both up there up front. I mean, we're just so used to Sulu and Chekhov, like, not being leads of the show, at least in the original run of things, or any, you know, Data and Geordi, but, you know, or Uhura in the early whatever. Everybody being in the... Yes, there's a hierarchy both of the Starfleet ranking system and of the actors and their professional, you know, who's got marquee over who's higher on an IMDb, on IMDb than others. But at least something. And something. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, of course, on The Next Generation, you got Data, Geordi, people like that. They all get their episodes, so we get to know them a fair bit, even though they're not the leads. But I have to say, the original series, Chekhov, Sulu, Uhura, Scotty, I really feel like I know all of them better just from watching those 79 episodes than I do any of the bridge crew on Discovery at this point.
Oh, there's no comparison.
It really shouldn't be that way with modern writing. It shouldn't be that way. They should be able to incorporate them in more, and they've really failed on that front. And I could sense in season two that there was a desire to do it, but then it lost in the mix
New
of
Eden,
the whole story.
In New Eden, Wosikin, Joanne goes on the... I remember seeing the pictures go, oh my God, they're letting her off the bridge, out of the mess hall. She's leaving the ship. What a concept. She's a
key part of the story.
And you thought that would be maybe a... And, you know, we had the head writer change. Maybe that was just one of the threads that was a goal in the beginning that went out the window when they had the change at the top. You know, it wasn't a huge, some things were, some things weren't, but there were definite changes, and maybe that was something that got lost in the shuffle.
You know, the moment when Pike asked everyone to tell me your names, because I want to know who I'm working with, that was a moment where I thought, like, okay, they realized that they completely failed to develop these characters in any way whatsoever in the first season, and they're going to fix it.
Right. If not for David's
and
book.
And they made a little bit of progress. But not enough, in my opinion. And so I'm hoping this season we're going to see more of that.
If not for the graphics they did for Talking Trek and David Mack's, you know, book, his initial Discovery book, a lot of those names would have gone right past most people. We'd all be digging around in the scraps of things to get people's full names and ranks and all that kind of thing.
Although I still have this burning question. Pike said, drop your ranks, they don't matter. And then they got to Arium, and she said, Lieutenant Commander Arium, I said your ranks don't matter.
And we all know what happened to her, don't we, Chris? Let that be a lesson to
that's
you.
That's right. Yeah. All right, Larry. Well, let's wrap this one up. So later this week, we'll finally get to see the first episode, That Hope Is You. And we'll go through a while, and maybe we'll do like we've done with Lower Decks. And when we get to the middle of the season, we can do like a mid-season recap. And before that, you and I have to get back together soon to do our Lower Decks full season recap now that we've gotten to the end.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely.
just for personal use.
I think we can throw on, at least one of us anyway, can throw on our First Contact DS9 era uniform for that one and maybe get an extra pip on our collar.
Yes. And sashay out of the room with your totally different next levels, you know, junior officer gliding out of the room and across the corridor. That's, I just love how they even animated them differently. It's funny. We're just going to take it over here, people. All right. Yes. Oh, Boimler.
All right. Yeah. So we'll talk about that later. Yes, but until then, so, Larry, if people want to find you, keep up with everything you have going on, because it's always so much, where should they go? What should they do?
Well, since your sun burned hot in space, I've awaited a question. No, head over. Yeah, LarryNemechuk.com is my website, my homepage. Right now, as we're recording this weekend, our friends Ryan and Sirach and the 7th Row Podcast bunch are doing another virtual TrekCon, and I'm going to have a Trekland virtual booth in the virtual dealer's room there all 5 days. So everybody go to LarryNemechuk.com. I'll have it posted. It's different hour. It's a 90-minute window that keeps rotating through the day, and it's that same way for everybody who has a air quotes booth. But that's happening, and then the big thing is at the end of the month, you'll see this also at my homepage at LarryNemechuk.com. It's the 5th anniversary, Chris, of Portal 47, your mini con all year long. And on the 28th, we're having an open house that I do every year. So that's the time we throw open the portal and everybody come in. We have a even more special guest than usual every year. There'll be a little bit of a roundtable time. People can have a little bit of open mic talk with a couple of themes I'll throw out. But the highlight of the evening is like an hour or more that we'll spend with a really special. We've had Mike Westmore. We've had Renee Echevarria. We've had Robert Hewitt Wolf. We've had David Livingston. We had Robert Butler, who directed The Cage in the past. So it's free. It's totally open for everybody. But
so, Larry, is it true that an upcoming guest is Badgie? Because if it's a virtual and Badgie's involved, I'm a little bit nervous.
You know, Chris, 2020 has been enough of a challenge without going out of my way to get Badgie on the guest list. Can I just leave it there? I don't want to insult anyone, but some guests, they're just a little harder to put up with than others. So, you know, some are just a little riskier than others. So I'd rather save that for a less stressful time.
Especially if the safety protocols are off.
Yes, obviously. Yes. I don't need to be taught a lesson, however you imply that.
All right. So again, to go to Portal 47, the best place to go is the website.
Yeah, just go to LarryNemechuk.com. Portal47.net's there, and you can read all about it. But all of these special events and offers and things, the best place to get everything, the hub for everything. Again, my schedule for Virtual TrekCon 2 and Open House coming up end of October and everything heading into the holidays is right there. At Larry Nemechuk on Twitter, Larry Nemechuk's Trekland on Facebook and Instagram, and I'm building up my YouTube channel. So we've got Life Support Live on Saturday mornings with Dr. Ali and Dr. Trek. One of us is a real doctor. And my Tuesday Trek Lives at 1 p.m. Pacific on Tuesdays. And those are on YouTube and Facebook. So I'm really trying to get subscribers over on my Larry Nemechuk YouTube channel. So I'd love it if everybody could go over and like and subscribe and do all the YouTube stuff and help get my numbers up.
You did my part for me there, Larry. One of them is a real doctor.
It's our I should see who I can farm the tagline out to just to break things up a little bit. But thank you for offering, Chris. Sorry I trampled on your line.
Always have to throw that in there. All right, great. You're very busy as usual. I am as well, except yes. Not doing this Star Trek related stuff as much as I would like to. But if you would like to catch some of the stuff I'm doing, I do have another podcast here on the network, Star Trek Universe Podcast, called Interphase. And I'll have a new episode of that out soon. Matthew Rushing and I do The Orb together, which is our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. We're also looking to do some new episodes soon. And Matthew and I have taken over once again as hosts of Literary Treks. We were the original hosts. And we had David Mack on recently to talk about his book, More Beautiful Than Death. And then we did another episode after that in which Matthew and I discussed the original series novel, The Fearful Summons, which was written by Denny Martin Flynn, who was one of the writers of The Undiscovered Country. and we'll have more episodes to come. We have Kirsten. Actually, we talked about Kirsten a lot tonight, Larry, and Kirsten's going to be joining us shortly to talk about her new Voyager novel.
Long-awaited Voyager novel.
And so that's coming up. And then we also talked about Janeway a lot, and I've been talking to Una about her coming on and talking about her new book, The Autobiography of Catherine Janeway. So a lot of good stuff on the horizon there for Literary Treks. And if you'd like to just share your thoughts on the episode, you can find me on Twitter. C. Brian Jones is my name, the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's where I'm most active, but you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that name. And then lastly, if you want to share thoughts with Larry and me about our discussion today, the best place to do that is actually on Facebook in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and it should come up. It is a closed group, so if you're not yet a member, you'll need to answer a few questions so I can let you in. But that's a great place to talk to us as well as other listeners, and there'll be a post there for this episode. You can also send us email if you go to trek.fm/contact and choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come along by the usual email methods. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on season 3 of Discovery and Janeway coming aboard and anything else that you want to share thoughts on from today's discussion. I'd also like to mention Patreon. It's very expensive and takes a lot of resources for us to produce these shows and distribute them. And the network could really use your help, especially during the current times with the coronavirus, because our support has dropped significantly as people have to reallocate their resources, understandably. So if you would like to help us keep the podcasts going, please go to patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. That's patreon.com/trekfm. You can find out everything you need to know there. We also have some interesting perks, such as the roundtable, where patrons get together with some of our hosts to talk about Star Trek in the way that we do here on all the other podcasts. And we publish that for everyone to listen to. You can also become an associate producer of our shows and also get involved in other ways. So please check that out, patreon.com/trekfm. And I'd like to thank everyone who is supporting the network. We really would not be able to do this without you. All right, Larry. Well, we've put in our full 2 hours as we usually do.
There's nothing to talk really about the new Discovery, Chris. I don't know what we're going to do.
Exactly. But I know it's getting really late there in Los Angeles, so we should let everyone get back to their days and let you turn in and let me deal with the evening here in Tokyo.
Absolutely. But I have to say, it's been great. I know it's always a struggle, but it's been great to be on the mic with you again more frequently the last few months than it had gotten to be there for a while. So it's been a wonderful time to be here. We've certainly, you know, filled up the hours, but I really think it's time to stick a tattered D-starred Federation flag pole in it because the Ready Room is done.